Today is Wednesday, August 30th. We're going to wrap up protein synthesis and cover membrane transport today. Okay, so we're on page 30 with protein synthesis. So during the last few minutes of class on Monday, we talked about this process of making proteins. You know, just to kind of make the connection, we've talked about dehydration synthesis before, which is a type of reaction used to make or build polymers. Well, protein synthesis is just an example of dehydration synthesis, and we use it to make polymers of proteins. So I just want to make the connection there between these two processes. This process of making proteins is actually a two-step process. It involves a process we call transcription and a process we call translation. And I wanted to make a point about these two words. Transcription comes first. This process occurs in your nucleus, and it rewrites DNA into what?
mRNA.
mRNA, good. And then translation is the second process. It occurs in your cytoplasm on ribosomes, and that's when we build what? You take codons, you use your codon chart, and you translate them into amino acids. Yep. And amino acids build
proteins.
Good. So that is the second step that we're going to look at too. If you have trouble keeping these two steps straight, just keep in mind they both begin with trans. That's not helpful. But when you look at the next letter, there's a C for transcription and there's an L for translation. Alphabetically, C comes before L. That's one way to remember that transcription is the first of the two processes. C comes before L. There's another clue. So if you look at transcription, the next letter is an R, and that's because we're making RNA during transcription. And if you look at translation, right after the L comes an A, that of course reminds us that we're making amino acids. So if you can remember those tricks come test time, they're pretty helpful. So there's three types of RNA made or available during transcription and translation. So I want to talk to you about mRNA, rRNA, and tRNA. Anybody need this slide before we go on? So to repeat what we covered in here on Monday, we know that transcription is the process that rewrites your DNA into RNA. And the rewriting process requires that we replace thymine or T's with uracil or U's. And so that's one easy way to distinguish between DNA and RNA. DNA contains thymines. What does RNA contain?
Uracil.
Yeah, so that's a great way to distinguish between those two. What we actually make during transcription is mRNA, otherwise known as messenger RNA. And of course, that's the one that will carry codes and forms of codons to make our proteins. So, you know, they always say, don't shoot the messenger, I just tell you what I know. That's the case here with messenger RNA. It's carrying a message built into codes. All right, just checking to see if anybody needs this slide. Good to go. Okay. All right, so the second step is translation. We use a codon chart. That codon chart is not something you need to memorize. I just want to put that out there because I've had people think that they have to memorize that codon chart. Oh gosh, no. We'll always provide that for you come test time. All you have to do is be able to read the codon chart and translate. So on that codon chart, what you've got are codons. And codons are groups of three nucleotides. Each nucleotide base a triplet codes for what? For a specific amino acid. So each codon codes for a specific amino acid. And just to back up a step, what type of RNA carries those codons?
mRNA.
mRNA, good, okay. So when we do this, That should say the tRNA, not the rRNA molecule, but the tRNA molecule starts translation at a start codon and stops at, guess what, a stop codon. So it's reading and translating, looking for the starts and the stops. Like I mentioned in the last few minutes of class on Monday, to make sure that you're doing this right, when I give you a strand of mRNA to translate, it will include a start and a stop. That way you know you've done it correctly. If you're not getting a start and a stop in your translation, then go back and double check your work. Okay? So the goal of translation is to make a strand of amino acids which form a protein. So let me correct that. That should say tRNA there. Just checking to see if anybody needs this slide. Y'all good to go? So let's detail the three types of RNA. We talked about them a little bit when we did transcription and translation on Monday. mRNA stands for messenger RNA. What does messenger RNA carry?
Is the code to the amino acid.
Good. And that code is for an amino acid. So how many base pairs make up a codon?
Three.
Good. So they're kind of like triplets, and each group of three is going to code for a particular amino acid. All right. So in just as an example here, AUG is a start codon. The next one you've got there is ACU, that's threonine. And then GGC is glycine. So that's how we break it up, is just count them off by groups of three. Okay. We also have rRNA, which stands for ribosomal RNA. And ribosomal RNA is important because it provides a site for translation to occur. So where do you find ribosomes? There's two locations you can find them. Good. Rough ER
in
cytoplasm. Good. So wherever they're located, they're going to be taking that strand of mRNA, and they allow for it to basically have a substrate or a site for this translation process to occur. And you know, when they talk about ribosomes, they actually talk about them as subunits. You'll notice there's a big subunit on top and a small one on the bottom, and I kind of jokingly think that these look like a hamburger bun. You've got the big piece on top and the smaller piece on the bottom. So that's what we've got, is two subunits that make up your ribosome. Nonetheless, this is where translation occurs. Ribosomes on your rough ER or ribosomes in your cytoplasm. And then finally, there's a tRNA molecule that plays a role here. We consider it to be transfer RNA. What is it transferring? Amino acids, good. So you ever go to a store and there's no price listed for the product, and you can't find a working barcode scanner machine that's set up in the store, and you walk around going, I really want to buy this, but I'm not really sure how much it costs. And so eventually you end up at the cash register where they can scan it, right? Okay, that's what tRNA is. It's a scanner, and it says, okay, give me your code. Your code is CCU, and then we're going to scan that and say, okay, that code's for this particular amino acid. So you and me, you know, we can look at these codes all day long, and unless you've memorized the codon chart, these codes are not going to mean anything to us. But the tRNA says, okay, I'm going to read that code, I scan it, and then I'm going to retrieve the appropriate amino acid based on what that code says. Because it's reading and scanning our codes or codons, we say your tRNA molecule carries what? Okay, so if your mRNA carries codons and your tRNA is scanning those codons, then what does your tRNA carry that's being able to read those codons?
The anticodon.
The anticodon, exactly. So just something to keep straight there. The messenger RNA carries the codons. The transfer RNA is reading those codons because it carries an anticodon.
What is the anticodon basically?
It's a complement. See, here's your codon. It's like GCC, and the anticodon is actually the complement. So it's, you know, C pairs with G. Yes, CGG would be your anti. So it's opposite, yeah. Just want to make sure we filled in the background information before we do another transcription and translation problem. All right, so why don't we take a moment to transcribe and then translate the strand of DNA. First of all, how do you know this is DNA written up here and not RNA?
It's got thymine.
Got T's for thymine, right. So that's the catch, of course. You have to remember to rewrite that T into what? Yeah, replace it with a U if you have it in the RNA. So I'm going to pause here and let you guys copy that down. All right, so we're switching gears and going to talk about membrane transport, and that involves kind of a revisit for the plasma membrane. Let me take you over to page 35. So what are the two layers of your plasma membrane constructed from? Phospholipids, good. And those phospholipids have heads oriented in what direction? Out, good. And the inner portion of your plasma membrane is composed of phospholipid tails. Now, going back a little bit, what portion of your phospholipid is hydrophobic?
The tails,
yeah. So the interior of your plasma membrane is water-fearing, and pretty much any polar substance like water is going to be excluded from your plasma membrane. Those heads that are pointing out are brave. They're hydrophilic, meaning what?
They like water.
They like water, good. We also have some other features here. We've got proteins that travel all the way through your plasma membrane. They're known as what?
Integral,
good. And proteins that are only sitting on one side or the other?
Peripheral.
They're peripheral, good. So we're going to involve some of those integral proteins today. We're going to look at them serving roles as protein channels, protein pumps. They're going to play an important role for membrane transport today. Something else I wanted to mention were some chemistry terms, solute, solvent, and solution. So when we're thinking about solute concentrations, we want to have an appreciation for what that terminology means. A solute is a substance dissolved by the solvent, and that's kind of like a strange definition for it, but it's typically the lesser amount when you're looking at a solute and a solvent. So you ever make sweet tea?
Yeah.
Okay, so you put the sugar in, right? The sugar is dissolved by the water that forms your tea. Is the sugar your solute or your solvent? It's your solute, right. In our bodies, we have small portions, that's a clue word, small portions of salts dissolved in our blood plasma. And so those salts that are dissolved in our blood plasma are what? They're solutes as well. And the small portion, the lesser amount there, is also another clue. In our bodies, the solvent tends to be blood plasma or interstitial fluids or even intracellular fluids. Those fluids are the ones dissolving the electrolytes, the solutes that are in our body. So in our overall picture, we're looking at water doing the dissolving, and that is, of course, a solvent for our bodies. So when you make sweet tea, of course, has tea and sugar, and the tea itself behaves as a solvent. We decided already the sugar behaves as your solute. It's being dissolved by your tea. Let's do another one. Let's make chocolate milk. If you take some Hershey syrup and pour it into some milk, what is the milk?
Solvent,
right. It's a larger amount, right? And the syrup that you pour in?
Solute,
right. Smaller portion. It's being dissolved by the solvent. What we end up with is a solution or a mixture of these two. We've got the solute being dissolved by the solvent. So in our bodies, we'll talk about solute concentrations. We're not terribly salty. We're around 1 or 2% salty. So we don't have incredibly salty bodies, but Nonetheless, there are solutes and salts dissolved in our bloodstream and our other fluids. We're going to talk today about passive and active transport. I've given you some space near the bottom of your page to jot down some notes. So I'll give you a moment to jot down this information if you'd like to have it. So while you're working through this, passive and active transport really dictate whether or not energy is being used. So if we're talking about passive transport, we know that molecules or substances can move across your plasma membrane without the use of ATP energy, and therefore we call it passive transport. We often see with passive transport some solutes moving from high concentration to low concentration, and we see that we're moving those substances along a concentration gradient. I kind of think of this like riding down a slide. If you're sitting on the top of a slide ready to ride, all it takes is a little push and there you go from high to low on your slide. So when you're traveling from an area of high concentration to an area of low concentration and you're going with the flow from high to low, we are looking at a passive process, meaning no ATP is required for the movement of those molecules from high to low. Okay, so let me put it to you this way. If somebody has gas at the dinner table and you're sitting nearby, it's coming to get you, right? So either you move or it's going to come to your nose and you're going to smell it. That's passive transport. No one has to move a finger for that odor to kind of waft through the air and reach your nose. It is diffusing or moving from an area of high concentration, the source, to an area of low concentration. So that is how concentration gradients work. You either go with the flow or you're going to have to go against the flow. So passively going with the flow is high to low. We're going to talk about simple diffusion, facilitated diffusion, osmosis. These are examples. We tend to see equilibrium, or in other words, we tend to see these particles spread evenly upon reaching that goal of getting all those particles moved out equal distance from each other. That is not going to be the case with active transport. You'll notice with active transport, we're typically moving molecules against a concentration gradient. We're having to go from low to high concentration, and you're never going to reach equilibrium if that's your job. Let me put it to you this way. If you've ever been to the park and you've looked at kids riding down the slide, that's the easy part, right? Go with the flow. But if they decide that they're going to climb up the slide for another ride, that's work. You know, we know that going around to the steps on the back is probably less work, but, you know, it's more fun to climb against the flow. And if you're going up the slide from low to high, that requires energy. And so we think anytime that you're going against the flow, that is going to be an active transport mechanism. Some examples we'll talk about are solute pumping, endo, and exocytosis. so just to kind of take this one step further, we've got passive transport example here with diffusion. If this was not labeled as diffusion, how would you know it is from high to low concentration? Yeah, you've got a high concentration here. Those molecules are moving across the membrane to an area of low concentration. Would you say those molecules are going with their concentration gradient or against it?
With.
They're going with it, right? Because they're going from high to low. That's going with the flow. Same thing here. We just happen to use a protein channel this time. But would you agree that we are still going with the concentration gradient?
Yes.
Yep. So do you need energy when you go with the flow?
No.
No ATP. Good. So this is just a passive process. The bottom picture shows us going from low concentration to high concentration, and this time we're going against the concentration gradient. So what do we have to use?
ATP.
ATP, which is energy. Good. Okay, so that's going to be kind of what we explore today, looking at these different types of membrane transport. I'm going to first talk to you about diffusion, and to avoid confusion with facilitated diffusion, I'm going to emphasize that it's called simple diffusion. So in your worksheet, I've just referred to it as diffusion, but it's technically simple diffusion.
36.
Yeah, that should be 36. Yeah, at the very top of your page.
Oh.
I did put simple in there, so we're good. In this animation, you're watching particles move from an area of high concentration to an area of low concentration. There is no input of energy required to do this. Just like an odor that you may smell, it diffuses from its source out to lower areas of concentration. Those molecules of odor bump and bounce against each other. Their own built-in kinetic energy allows for them to spread to areas of lower concentration. When those molecules are spread evenly, like we see in this animation, then we say that we have reached equilibrium. And so the movement may not stop completely. There still may be a little bit of adjusting for equilibrium. But what do you notice about the distance between all those particles?
Spaced evenly,
right. So that's really the goal here of equilibrium, is to space out those particles evenly. By moving those particles from area of high concentration toward their areas of lowest concentration, we can achieve spreading them into an equilibrium setup. Same thing here, they're kind of illustrating letting a gas out of a bottle. In other words, you're letting the odor come out, and when that molecule mixes with the environment, just through random kinetic energy, then we can spread it to areas of lower concentration. I just want to repeat, there is no input of ATP here for your cells to move molecules from high to low concentration. It's all done from the random bouncing of particles against each other. That random bouncing is what moves them from areas of high to areas of low concentration. You know, we have to think about your plasma membrane because it's kind of picky. Let's go back and talk about your membrane for just a moment. We know the phospholipid tails are hydro-what?
Phobic,
right. And that means they do not like
water.
Or polar. Yeah, if you're water, if you're polar, you know, those tails say, you're not cutting it, you're not coming through here. So in order for molecules to diffuse across your membrane, they can't be polar and they can't be water-based. So that creates some issues for us because we've got a lot of water-based items, including water, that needs to move across your membrane. So we have to play by the tails' rules. The tails say no polar substances and no water-based substances. If, however, you are non-polar, or if you are small and fatty, you can come through the plasma membrane. So let me draw your attention there to the top of the page. If you're small, or if you're non-polar, like a fat, the tails say come right on across. Okay, so those are the rules for diffusion. You have to be a small substance, or you have to be a fatty substance. And that's near the top of page 36. What do your phospholipid tails say about water and polar substances?
They don't want nothing to do with them.
Don't want nothing to do with them yet. You can stay out. I'm not letting you across. But if you're a small item or if you're non-polar like a fat, come right on through. Since these particles can move across our plasma membrane, we're going to assume either they are small enough to fit through the phospholipid bilayer, like blood gases, oxygen and carbon dioxide, or I'm going to assume that they're fat. They could be a steroid, like testosterone or cholesterol. They could be a saturated fat, like butter. It could be an unsaturated fat, like some oils. So, you know, it has to be either a tiny molecule, like an ion, or some kind of fat, back from when we covered lipids, that can travel across this plasma membrane. Okay, so that actually answers number four, about midway down your page. Some examples of substances that can move by diffusion. Letter A, small substances like oxygen and carbon dioxide. Small substances like oxygen and carbon dioxide. Letter A, small substances like oxygen and carbon dioxide. Or letter B, fats like steroids, testosterone, estrogen, oils. So fats include all sorts of things, steroids, testosterone, estrogen, oils. So letter B there, fats like steroids, testosterone, estrogen, oils, anything that's in that lipid category should be able to come across your plasma membrane. A little below that, you'll notice some things that influence diffusion rates. What are the two items that influence diffusion rates?
Temperature and
good. So what do you think? Hot temperature or cold temperature will speed your diffusion rates? Yeah, hot temperatures, exactly. So to fill in that blank there, warmer temperatures will speed up or increase diffusion. Warmer temperatures will increase or speed up diffusion. On a hot summer day, your blood gases move more quickly because, of course, we're looking at a higher body temperature on a hot summer day. Fevers also increase the rate of diffusion. So we may see an increased demand for oxygen and the need to get rid of CO2. So we're thinking about body temperature here as playing a role in diffusion rates. What is another word for viscosity? Thickness, right. So we're thinking about the thickness of the fluids in your body. And some things that can change the thickness of your fluids include dehydration or disorders like anemia. So when we're looking at the viscosity or the thickness of your blood or your fluids, then we're looking at the speed of diffusion rates changing. So to fill in your blank there, it says diffusion rates increase the thicker the fluid, the faster diffusion occurs when you've got a thinner fluid. When you've got a thicker fluid, the diffusion rates will decrease. So that blank there is decrease. Or the slower, rather. That makes better sense, doesn't it? Okay, so the thicker the fluid, the slower the diffusion rates. So something you might think about is, you know, diffusion of a blue dye through water versus diffusion of a blue dye through, say, Vaseline. The thicker the fluid, the harder it is for those dye molecules to make a move. So in our bodies, that's kind of the same concept. The thinner the fluid, the faster the rate. Thicker the fluid, the slower the rate. Okay, so far, can you think of some things that summarize how diffusion works for the bottom of the page?
Doesn't require ATP.
Doesn't require ATP, that's a good one.
To
Yeah, we're moving from high to low.
And equilibrium.
Good. Our goal here is equilibrium. Good. So no ATP required. Moving molecules from high to low. And our goal is equilibrium. So no ATP required. We're going from high to low concentration. And our goal is equilibrium. How about questions on simple diffusion? All right, let's talk about osmosis over on page 37. We often talk about osmosis as the diffusion of water, but in fact, we're looking at water moving because solutes sometimes cannot move across the membrane. You know, we're looking at small items or lipid-based items being able to move across your plasma membrane. Other items that are water-based or large may not be able to move across your plasma membrane. So we describe your plasma membrane as semi-permeable or selectively permeable because of its picky nature. It can select what travels across into that or out of that membrane. So that's just something to think about here. The reason that osmosis occurs is because sometimes the solutes cannot move. Therefore, water moves toward an area of higher solute concentration. Okay, so just something to keep in mind. Water is what's moving during osmosis, and it's moving toward the higher solute concentration. That may seem backwards, right? Because what have we said for most of our passive processes? What are we moving from? High to low. Yeah. Passive, right. So this may seem a little uncomfortable because we're not going high to low. We're actually going from low water to high water concentration, to high solute concentration, rather. It's a little weird in that we're moving kind of in a different direction here with osmosis. Just checking to see if you need this slide. Good, okay. So kind of cool, this is about 15 years ago or so, they discovered aquaporins. And aquaporins are integral proteins that travel all the way through your plasma membrane. Up until then, they were kind of puzzled, how does water get across the plasma membrane? Because they knew that those phospholipid tails were hydrophobic and didn't want water to come across. So, you know, nowadays, you know, we know that aquaporins are protein channels, and it is their job to let water travel from areas of low solute concentration to areas of high solute concentration. So, kind of cool that, you know, we've lived through a really important discovery here, and this is not all that old. About 15 years ago, this was discovered. In this image, they didn't include aquaporins, but we can still appreciate what's happening. Let's see, the water molecules are blue and the solutes are green, and the solutes cannot travel across the membrane. So that is a catch here, that the water can move, but the solutes cannot. So in what direction will those water molecules move? Okay, so you're exactly right. Low what to high what?
Low concentration to high concentration.
Good, and what is the concentration that we're looking at?
The molecules,
yeah. So we're moving from an area of low solute concentration or molecule concentration to an area of high solute or molecule concentration. What is the goal of having those water molecules move?
Equilibrium.
Equilibrium. Yeah, get those molecules evenly distributed and spread out. So if this was sugar, then of course the sugary side would become more diluted. And that's that's because water is moving to that area of higher solute concentration. Same concept here, you know, on the right-hand side, they're showing us sugar molecules in green, and the water can travel across the membrane that's right here through the middle, but the sugar molecules cannot. So again, the water molecules are traveling to where we've got more solutes, and the goal is to do what?
Reach
equilibrium. And the water's going to move to that saltier or sugary area until you reach equilibrium. Okay, so that's kind of what we want to talk about today, is three situations dealing with osmosis: isotonic, hypotonic, and hypertonic solutions. Okay, so I'm going to put that on pause. Let's raise the screen and we'll look at some pictures. Solutions to start off with. We know solutions contain solutes and solvents, and when you're talking about an isotonic solution, you're comparing it to the cells that we're putting in there. Iso as a prefix means what?
Same.
Good. So we're saying that this solution has the same concentration of solutes as our cells have. So if we take a cell and we put some solutes inside of it using those X's, and we put that cell in a solution with the same concentration, do we expect any movement of water?
No.
No movement. This is your cell's happy place, right?
Right.
Okay, so there's no great movement of water in, no great exiting of water. This is what we consider equilibrium for your cell. Another cell and place it into a hypotonic solution, we are saying that this solution is less concentrated than our cell. We know the prefix hypo means below or under, or in our case here it also means less concentrated. So I've placed it in a solution with less solutes. Okay, so we know that the solutes may not be able to move to equalize themselves, but the water can move through aquaporins to create an equal environment. Because water always moves to the more highly concentrated environment, this time, where does water move?
Into the cell.
Good. And what is the goal?
To reach equilibrium.
Good. All right. So in case you're having trouble reading it from the back. The first sentence there says, solution is less concentrated than the cell. Solution is less concentrated than the cell. The second one says, water moves to higher concentration. Water moves to the higher concentration. And the goal, of course, here is to reach equilibrium with our salt or solute concentration. Our goal is equilibrium. Questions there in your worksheet below the hypotonic solution information says, what are two reasons that water will enter a cell when placed in a hypotonic solution? Water's moving to the higher concentration. Water follows salt. You probably heard that right. Okay. And then secondly, the goal is to reach equilibrium. And so water enters the cell to reach equilibrium. The two questions there, it says, why does water move into the cell during a hypotonic solution? Water moves to the higher salt concentration, and the goal is to reach equilibrium. Example using numbers, if we have a cell with a 3% solute or salt concentration, we're going to place it in a hypotonic solution. Can you give me a number for that solution? Below. Yep, so as long as it's below 3%, then you've got a hypotonic solution. 0.8 would work, yeah. 0 would work. Okay. So if you're struggling to figure out which way does water move, just keep in mind that water is going to move to the higher solute concentration, and in this case, it's going to travel into your cell. What happens to the shape of a cell when it's placed in a hypotonic solution? It's going to swell, bloat, and it's going to keep letting water in to try to reach equilibrium, and it may
burst
or rupture. Good. So if you have trouble keeping these straight, just keep in mind the O in hypo and the O in bloat are great ways to keep this one straight. Water comes in to bloat your cells and hypotonic solutions. I've also had students tell me that they remember it because hypo sounds like hippo, and of course those cells are going to bloat like a hippo. So when we drink fluids, pretty much every fluid we drink is a hypotonic fluid, and we often drink because we're thirsty and we're dehydrated. Your body will, of course, tell you when to drink, and you normally no longer feel the urge to drink when you've saturated your body with enough water. You will stop drinking, most likely, before you get to the point of bursting your cells. There's a mechanism called the thirst mechanism. We normally listen to it, and so we drink when we're thirsty, and we stop when we're saturated. So that keeps you from bloating and bursting your cells. Some cells in your body that are really ones we want to avoid bloating are brain cells. So that can cause your brain to push against the skull, push it down in your foramen magnum, and cut off brainstem activity. So not a good thing. All right, so let's take a hypertonic solution. We'll do that one next. Our helpful clue this time is hyper. What does that indicate?
Over excessive.
Over excessive. Good. So this time we've got a cell in a more concentrated solution. Let's go back and say that our cell has a 3% solute concentration. Can you give me a number if our solution is hypertonic to the cell?
4%.
4% works good. Since these solutes may not be able to move to reach equilibrium, the only thing we can do to equalize solute concentration is to move what?
The water.
The water, right. And so in what direction will the water move?
To the outside of the cell.
Good, to the outside of the cell. And what happens to the shape and size of your cell?
It shrivels up.
It shrivels up, good. And so the fancy word for shriveling cells is crenate. I don't want to confuse that with cremate because we're not going to do that to them. But of course, shriveled cells have an E. Hypertonic also has an E, so that's another great clue. Basically, the answer to the two questions near the bottom of your page are the same. Water always goes to the higher solute concentration. If it happens to be in solution, then water leaves your cell. And the reason for doing this is to equalize solute concentrations. There was a contest in California called Hold Your Wii for the Nintendo Wii. They invited participants to come into the radio station and they said, okay, here's your gallons of water that you're supposed to drink. The last one to pee is the one who gets the console, the Nintendo Wii console.
And it was a girl and she got killed because she drank so much water to the point where her foot, where her organs were really floating in the water.
Yes, exactly. She was a 28-year-old mom of three kids, thought she'd win that console, went home with a headache. Yeah. So unfortunately, you know.
How much did she drink? Like a few gallons?
It must have been a few gallons. Yeah, and a nurse called in the radio station and said, this is stupid, you're going to hurt people. And they said, no, we cleared it with our lawyers. And I'm thinking their lawyers didn't have science class. So. No. So your kidneys can only filter about a half a cup to a cup of fluid per hour. And if you're drinking gallons of water in 30 minutes, your kidneys just say, I give up, I can't do this.
So, fluid overload,
yeah. So her brain swelled, that's what killed her. That's why she had a really awful headache. And you know, had she been able to get treatment immediately, because this is fast.
She could have got the water out of her.
They could pull the water out of her. And if she came into the hospital, which of these three solutions would you give her to pull the water out?
Hypertonic solution.
Yeah, why give her hypertonic?
Because it'll take water out the cells.
Yeah, pulls water out the cells, right. It's like giving a salty solution to somebody. It literally sucks the water out of your cells. What would happen to your urine output if you were given a hypertonic solution?
Increase,
yeah. Same thing, you know, every... So often they run the game show Survivor. They plop these people somewhere in the middle of nowhere. And then the first few days they say, okay, you know, good luck getting some water. And they tease them with, you can have fire. And so it's really interesting to watch the debate. If you've ever seen that show, they always talk about, I'm going to go and drink that nasty, dirty water that I saw up here in a mud puddle. And somebody else says, you've got the entire ocean out here. Why not just drink that? Dry yourself out, yeah. So you would pull the water out of your cells, you would pee like crazy.
That's why they say that you've got to heat the water up to get the salt out.
And then you capture the condensation, yeah. So if you drink that salt water, you've got a week, and that's it. It'll kill you. It'll shut your kidneys down. It'll give you horrible hallucinations. The better choice is to drink the dirty-looking muddy water up in the hills.
So go ahead and drink the ocean.
Go ahead and drink. Tell them you drink the ocean. I'm going to go drink the muddy water because you have an immune system that at least has a chance of fighting off whatever's infecting that water. Yeah.
The immune system can't fight off salt.
The immune system cannot fight off salt, yeah. You're dead in the water. They're fine. What I've got for you on page 38 and 39 are a set of practice problems. And if you'll try those, what we'll do is we'll work on those a little bit. And I'm going to finish up the chapter right now with page 41. And if you need help going over those practice pages, I'll do that for you. So on page 41, let's take a look at our last type of passive transport. So we know with simple diffusion, we can move solutes that are small, or we can use lipid-based items through our plasma membrane. But with facilitated diffusion, we're actually moving larger items that cannot squeeze through the phospholipid bilayer. Because larger items might rip a hole in your phospholipids, we instead use a protein channel to help move these bigger particles like glucose molecules. So what part of the description on this slide tells you that we're doing a passive transport process?
No ATP.
Good. That's one good clue. No ATP is required here. And what's another clue? Passive transport says it to you, right? And we're going with the gradient. Yeah. And of course, going with the gradient means you're going from high to low concentration. Good. Okay, so let's see. I've got you a couple of blanks there to fill in. How does diffusion differ from facilitated diffusion? Yeah, this type here, facilitated, uses larger molecules, or transports rather larger molecules. And I heard one of you say it, we got to use a protein channel. That's right. That's your second difference. First one is we're using facilitated diffusion for larger molecules. We use facilitated diffusion to transport larger molecules. And secondly, we're going to use a protein channel. On Wednesday of next week, we'll do a little bit of epithelial tissues, maybe a little connective, but do bring your questions for test number one. We'll spend some time toward the end of class. I'll just open the floor and let you guys ask questions. Okay? Y'all have a great Labor Day.
Thank you, Jill.